Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotkin coming at you live from my house, and it is Monday afternoon. We do book club class on Monday afternoons, and we are going to almost finish up this book, The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy, by the really unique Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. We're almost done with the book. This is going to be the very, very last essay that he's going to give of any great import. There's going to be an epilogue at the very, very end. It's like 2 pages long. His thoughts on the Six-Day War. Of course, we're going to read that. But this one that we're going to start today on page 205 takes us all the way through to, oh, goodness, practically the very end. And that's on page 221. There's no guarantee we're going to get there today, but let's see where we go. Maybe we will. The Mizrahi and the Jewish Dance of Eternity, delivered in November 1958, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, Teshuvah is not connected exclusively with sin, as is commonly assumed. It embraces much more than purification from sin. It is possible that Teshuvah gives expression to the Jewish worldview. It's not for naught that the Talmud in Nedarim 39b states that Teshuvah is a primordial idea, meaning from before the beginning of the world. One of the seven things created before the world came into existence. See Psalm 90, verses 2 and 3. Before the mountains came into being, before you brought forth the earth and the world, you returned man to dust. You decreed, return, you mortals. In truth, Teshuvah denotes the capacity for retrospection and hindsight, being able to turn around and consider the bygone past, that which was created, whose potential has been realized. For instance, a person riding in the last car of a train can stand for hours on end at the back door, watching the landscape disappearing very quickly into the distance, continuously observing the route the train travels and from which he, the traveler, takes leave. Even when a person goes somewhere by foot, he will stop and cast a glance backward. Animals do not have this habit. They sprint forward without pausing and never turn around to look at the path down which they have run, except the dog, which awaits its owner. We know that occasionally turning around is part of human nature from the warning given by the angel to Lot as he was escaping the burning Sodom. Flee for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the hills, lest you be swept away. See Genesis 19, verse 17. The fact that Lot had to be told not to look back shows that human nature is to turn around. Top page 206. In essence, retrospection and hindsight are characteristic, as if one could say this, of the creator of the world. On that magnificent Friday evening, after God had created the world, when the magnificent Shabbat Queen appeared for the first time in a new, fresh, pure world, before he recited the first Kiddush, the first Vayechulu HaShemayim, God cast a contemplative look back at the 6 days of creation, at the world that had been born, and considered the past, that which had been realized. Quote, God saw all that he had made and found it very good. Genesis 1, verse 31. Only when, during that divine retrospection, creation found favor in God's eyes, did he then sanctify and bless the Shabbos day. Quote, God blessed the seventh day and declared it holy. Genesis chapter 2, verse 3. Such wondrous hindsight is the foundation of teshuva, confession, and introspection. Tonight, too, I wish to treat the matter of God saw all that he had made. Such a contemplation of the past or gaze into prehistory is, for us Mizrahi members, a timely matter at this conference, which is being held during a crisis. A Harat Olam period for us religious Jews who see the building of the land and the establishment of the state as instances of divine visitation who bear the full burden of responsibility for the shaping of a state of Israel that does not desecrate the holiness of the land and the covenant between the parts, and who suffer physically and spiritually when we encounter obtuse stubbornness and vulgarity, specifically among those whose accomplishments in connection with the existence of the state of Israel are great. What is he talking about? Who is a Jew? That's going to be the discussion over here. And he's talking about many otherwise worthwhile Israelis who were very involved in the creation of the state. He's going to say that they are ignorant and they display their ignorance and they're vulgar over here, vulgarity, obtuse stubbornness. He's talking about the great politicians of the state of Israel at the beginning of the state and 10 years after the creation, of the state of Israel, and how they're just not showing the respect needed for this question of who is a Jew. Me, Yehudi. The mitzvah of teshuvah and introspection or contemplation of the past is closely bound up with historical transition, distress, not in layman's terms, but in the halachic philosophical sense, crisis, hardship, a time when prophecy, divine urge, agency becomes a burden and man finds himself on the verge of crying out, quote, the strength of the basket carrier has failed and there is so much rubble. See Nehemiah 4, verse 4. And Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 30, when you are in distress because all these things have befallen you, and in the end, you return to the Almighty your God. What I say tonight should not be thought of as a sermon or lecture. I do not intend to rule on halachic matters or even to enter into the fields of Torah Navalai or homiletics. Top 207. The question of who is a Jew was decided long ago by a Jew who was a greater scholar than all the Jewish sages to whom the Israeli government is preparing to send the weighty question, me who Yehudi, or me Yehudi, who is a Jew? Namely, it was taught by our teacher Moses, quote, you shall not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your children away from me to worship other gods. See Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. Rashi there on the Pasuk cites the Talmud in Kiddushin 68b, and the discussion is closed. I wish today to speak more intimately with my listeners, to share my feelings and impressions. Together with my colleagues, I would like to fulfill, quote, and God saw all that he had made, retrospection, contemplation of the past. Simply put, I wish to confess, not so much over a burnt or sin offering, as much as about my experiences in connection with the land of Israel and the religious movement to return to Zion. From this backward glance, I will, of course, come to look toward the future. From the question, where am I coming from, will emerge, where are we headed? See Avot, chapter 3, Mishnah 1. This is not a programmatic speech. It is simply a sicha, a conversation among friends. True, it is a paradoxical sicha. Only one person is speaking while the others are silent. We find, however, that the Bible uses the term sicha, conversation, in reference to a monologue. See Psalm 102, verse 1, a prayer of the lowly man when he is faint and pours forth sicho, his plea, before the Almighty. Till here, the introduction. Let us begin with an episode from this past summer. At the end of June, a day of learning was held at which I spoke the whole day. It seems to me that my lecture lasted 5 hours with a break for lunch. I fasted nearly the entire day. My intentions were certainly good. After the sermon, we immediately traveled home. Then Laban left on his journey homeward. Jacob went on his way. Genesis 32. Whether I encountered angels of the land of Israel meaning that my sermon was worthwhile, or angels of other lands, meaning that my sermon was worthless, I do not know. But one thing was clear to me. I deserved to be commended. After all, the Talmud says that one is rewarded at the Kala, the semi-annual study session, not so much for the great chidushim, novelai that one develops, as for the crowding, for the trouble to which one goes. See the Gemara Brachot 6b. As such, I should have been thanked for giving a five-hour lecture, but I initially did not receive even one thank you letter. Radio silence. Well, I thought to myself, the Jews present at the lecture are not familiar with the opinion of Rabbeinu Bachaya that gratitude constitutes the foundation of Judaism. Sichovot halavavot sha'ar habechina. It's too bad. Top page 208. And there was evening and there was morning. Genesis 1, verse 5. A month or two passed. Elul arrived. The shofar of the high holidays started blowing. All of a sudden, I began receiving thank you letters from all over, from New York, and even from Jerusalem, full of enthusiasm and excitement in the manner of Jewish men who, quote, provide and support with exaggeration and clever turns of phrase. See the standard Kesuba text. One morning, a package from New York was delivered to my house. I opened it and found inside a gift of cups and a silver decanter. Who sent it to me? Again, the Mizrahi, as a token of appreciation for the sermon. Well, I thought to myself, it is, after all, the Teshuva season, the days of mercy and conciliation. So one need not question Jews' action. A couple of weeks later, I read in the newspaper that the Mizrahi was planning a convention and that my friend, Rabbi Samuel Sar, was appointed chairman. And then everything became clear as day. It was not thoughts of Teshuva that inspired everyone to send me all of those friendly letters and those cups, but the shrewdness of Rabbi Samuel Sar. He figured that Rabbi Soloveitchik felt insulted and that he certainly would not come to the conference. How could one invite him when the backbreaking work he had put into the day of learning had not been appreciated? Therefore, atonement had to be sought by mailing in many thank you letters and a present. What did Jacob say to himself when he sent the gift to Esav? Quote, if I atone with presents in advance and then face him, that is, to invite him to that convention, then perhaps he will show me favor, thought Jacob, and I would come to the convention. A couple of days after the arrival of the gift, I received an invitation from Rabbi Samuel Sar to participate in the conference. I'll let you in on a secret. As much as it may have upset me this summer not to have received even one commendation, and as many decisions as I may have made not to speak at any more of the gatherings and conferences of the Mizrahi, I would have obviously ignored all those vows. I would have come to the conference, and I would have relied on saying Kol Nidre on Yom Kippur. At my shul, they recite the old version, from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur. I would not have fulfilled a single vow. You didn't need the present to get me to come to the conference. And whoever bought it must repay the organization the money spent. We rule that one is responsible for cases of indirectly caused damage. See Maimonides, Hilchos Chovel Umazik, chapter 7, top page 209. Why am I telling you this meaningless and silly little tale? Because this small episode caused me to begin to better understand my own relationship with the religious movement to return to Zion in the same way that, quote, Gemara Yevamos 92b, quote, had I not lifted the shard for you, would you have discovered the pearl beneath it? I suddenly realized that as angry as I might be, as upset as I might be at particular leaders, and as much as I might hate some of the decisions made based on practical, pragmatic considerations, I cannot break the bond between me and the Mizrahi. I am in a state of, quote, Joseph could no longer control himself. See Genesis 45. Whether or not it is worth the trouble for me to confess to my brothers, Joseph must divulge this secret. In every instance of an individual connecting with an idea, there are three phases. I have experienced all three in my attachment to the Mizrahi. These three phases are reflected in the three different connotations of the Hebrew verb choshev. At the end of the day, connecting with a movement is an internal gesture. The payment of dues does not make someone into a member. Inner dedication on the part of the person, that's realized through the choshev act. In Hebrew, choshev means to calculate, as in choshev cheshbonot, reckoning accounts. See Ecclesiastes 7. But they have engaged in too much cheshbonot, calculus. See Numbers 21. Ba'u cheshbon, come to cheshbon. Come and nechashev. Let us calculate the cheshbonot, the account of the world. That's Baba Basra 78b. The first phase of an individual's connection with an idea is based on practical cheshbonot. The individual joins the movement not because he believes in the idea and in the possibility of bringing it to fruition, but because of his desire to achieve other objectives. By achieve other objectives, I mean simply making friends. Genesis 2, it's not good for man to be alone. Maimonides and Moreh Nevuchim, man is naturally social. He despises solitude. He wants someone to whom he can pour out his heart, recount his worries, and brag about his successes. Maimonides, in his commentary on the Mishnah, alludes to a chaver ledagar, a friend with whom one can share one's concerns. And so, in his search for comrades, man joins a movement even when he does not well understand its ideology. He is a choshev cheshbonot, top of 210. When I came to America years ago, I felt the bitterness of loneliness, the need for companionship. I would often cry in private out of despair. When I joined the Mizrahi movement, it was not out of devotion to the cause, but because of the need for companionship. To whom could I attach myself? In the Mizrahi, I found friends who do not check others' tithis or play around with bans, B-A-N-S. Like an excommunication ban. I found friends who know how much one can and must demand. And in particular, I found people who believe in a fundamental principle of Judaism. Who is like your people Israel, one nation on earth? See 2 Samuel 7. I must say that I found then in the Mizrahi true comrades with whom I maintain a friendship down to the present day. Choshev also means to think. To ponder, as in choshev machshavot, to ruminate. In the second phase, an individual's connection with an idea or movement representing it comes to be founded upon deep understanding and hakara, recognition of the importance of that idea. A chaver l'da'aga is elevated to a new level, that of a chaver l'da'a, a friend with whom one shares ideals. The practical person, the choshev cheshbonot, links up with a higher type, the choshev machshavot, the theoretician. Later on, especially with the founding of the State of Israel, I slowly migrated from the level of choshev cheshbonot, at lowest level, in the direction of choshev machshavot, the theoretician's level. From chaver l'da'aga, from a friend with whom you share your pain and suffering, to a chaver l'da'a, to a colleague with whom you share ideas. I began thinking through the entire complex of problems relating to the land of Israel, its secular leaders, and the role of the Mizrahi and upon the Mizrahi in the course of the first 5 or 6 years of the state's existence. On one side is a powerful party that controls both the country's politics and its economy, that demonstrates such lack of understanding of our historical traditional Torah way of life, of our spiritual values and ideals, and that treats the main principles of Jewish historical and meta-historical experience so vulgarly and foolishly, insulting the sages of the tradition, ridiculing rabbis and Torah giants, and ruling on halacha questions of the greatest importance to the Jewish world with the chutzpah of a president of the International Longshoremen's Association. Here, of course, he's talking about the Mapai and the Mapam and the Avodah, the labor. I'm sorry, is it the labor? Yeah, it is labor. The labor party, the basically communist, socialist, Marxists who helped to found the state of Israel. And these, of course, are the ones who control the country's politics and economy, but they also demonstrate a lack of understanding of the historical traditional Torah way of life. They insult the sages of the tradition. They ridicule the rabbis and the Torah giants. That's what you get out of the Mapai, the Mapam, and Hashomer Hatzair, and the labor movement. Top page 211. On the other side is a minority, a small party, lacking political and economic might, financial means, and other weapons, that leads a tireless struggle to save the foundations of Judaism. While all those on the right, who should have supported and strengthened the leaders of the movement, throw stones and both directly and indirectly help the Mapai and the Mapam of all things. And still the movement has defended the prestige of Orthodox Jewry. If Shabbat sanctity, kashrut, mikvot, synagogues, a new yeshivot, an organized chief rabbinate, family sanctity, is marriage and divorce for transfer to the hands of the sages of Israel, and most importantly, religious education, whether the state religious schools, the independent religious schools, the Bnei Akiva yeshivas, or even the old yeshivot gedolot, well, if they all exist today in the land of Israel, it is only on account of the heroic struggle led by the Mizrahi. If there were religious kibbutzim and a religious labor movement through which Orthodox Jewry can claim a part in the land, in the building of the land, it is only on account of the Mizrahi. Ultimately, every Jew must have at least a portion in the land. The Gaonim write that there is no one who has no land. And for that reason, a person can transfer ownership of movable property, derech agav, bundled together with immovable property, even when he thinks he owns no real estate, because he certainly has a portion in the world to come. I'm sorry, he certainly has a portion in the land of Israel, not in the world to come, but he's got a portion in the land of Israel. See Numbers 26, among these shall the land be apportioned as shares, according to the listed names, end quote. Every Jew who has a Jewish name, who is among those counted, who has a sense of responsibility, and is considered to be one of the, quote, one of those in Israel who are able to bear arms, a fighter and a soldier who must have an inheritance in the land of Israel. A fighter and soldier must have an inheritance in the land of Israel. Who procured this inheritance for us Orthodox Jews in the modern state of Israel? And when I say inheritance, I mean simply schools, fields, rabbis, orchards, a youth movement, a labor organization, pioneers, and so on. Who, if not the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi, stuck his hand into the historical lottery box and drew the historical lot for Orthodoxy? Quote, the land, moreover, is to be apportioned by lot. Numbers 26. So future historians should not be able to say about Orthodox Jewry that which Chazal declared regarding Job. Lo hayo v'lo nivra. He never existed and he was never created, but it's simply a parable. See Baba Basra 15a. I regularly make use of Maimonides' approach to the question of attributes. See Hilchos Yisodei Torah, chapter 1. Namely, that one can always achieve a proper appreciation of the significance of a person or a movement by imagining its opposite. What would it be like if this person or movement did not exist or were not devoted to a given ideal? The psalmist wonders even about the master of the universe. Quote, were it not for the Almighty who was on our side, let Israel now declare, were it not for the Almighty who was on our side when men assailed us. If one wishes to more, that's Psalm 124, if one wishes to more profoundly understand the Creator, one must ask himself, what would become of us if he were to abandon us? Hoshe Pershe means to want, to further. to want, to desire, to will. Machshava denotes will, such as in, such as my machshava. Menachos chapter 29. I'm sorry, Menachos 29b. Again, choshev means further to want, to desire, to will. Machshava or machashava denotes will, as in such is my machashava. That is to say, such is my will. Besides, although chashavtem, you intended me harm, God chashva, he intended it for good. You wish to do me harm. But the Almighty's wish was that your act would do me good. You wish to do me harm, but the Almighty's wish was that your act would do me good. Joseph to his brothers. An individual's connection with an idea, when it reaches the highest level of devotion and loyalty, rests not on chishuv cheshbonot, not on a think a practical, super pragmatic kind of a, you know, utilitarian calculus, nor even on chashivat machshavot, or even on theoretical ideas and ideologies and so on of harkara, but rather rests on machshava, will. The person is overcome by a personal drive, by a powerful drive. The person is overcome by a powerful drive, an almost superhuman and supernatural desire that cannot be explained or rationalized, to labor in support of the idea. He does not ask why, and he does not require any intellectual, rational elucidations or explanations. He is filled with an elemental force to serve the cause and to sacrifice for its implementation. Such is his will. Love that is based not on chishuv cheshbonot, practical, very, very elementary and practical considerations, nor even on chashivat machshavot, a higher level of theoreticians. Love that's based not on either one, but rather on such is my will, that's the mightiest love. That is the love of a father for his children, of King David, King of Israel, for Absalom. 2 Samuel chapter 18, David said to his men, deal gently with my boy Absalom. Do it for my sake. And then when he was dead, wasn't it David, his father, who cried out, my son Absalom, oh my son Absalom. 2 Samuel 19. No matter how much the child might sin against his father, no matter how much he might rebel against his father, no matter how much he might violate his father's honor, the father's love for him does not diminish. Not chishuv cheshbonot, not chashivat machshavot, not all that practical considerations or theoretical thoughts, but rather, what do you have? Machshava, will. And David showed Absalom unending love. It is not for naught, top of page 213, it is not for naught that Chabad understands Keter, the crown, to be the supernal will above the sphira of Chokhmah, wisdom. See Sefer HaTanya, Igeret HaKodesh, chapter 29. Nor is it for naught that Maimonides implied that Shigaon of David, see Psalm 7, verse 1. Nor is it for naught that Maimonides implied that Shigaon of David in Psalm 7 should be understood as David's Shigaon, David's madness. David's love for the creator of the world was a type of madness. In other words, a love that transcended hakara, recognition. Turn back, O maid of Shulam. Turn back, that we may gaze upon you. Song of Songs, chapter 7, verse 1. The nations of the world said to them, turn back, O maid of Shulam, and we will make you rulers, dukes, and chiefs. See Midrash Tanchuma, Parshas Bamidbar, section 11. It is not worth it to be a Jew, neither from the perspective of chishuv machshavot, practical thinking, nor from that of chashivat machshavot, more ideological, more theoretical thinking. Come to us, that we may gaze upon you. Let us analyze this logically. Song of Songs, chapter 7, verse 1, again. Why will you gaze at the Shulamite in the Machanayim dance? No logical arguments can convince me. It is useless to philosophize and explain why I sacrifice for my Judaism. Quote, why will you gaze at the Shulamite? Why do you want to understand the Shulamite? Quote, in the Machanayim dance, end quote. She is mesmerized in an endless dance that can never be interrupted. I have cast myself into the dance of eternity, not because of cheshbonot, plain and simple thinking, but nor because of machshavot, higher level theoretical ideological thinking, but because I am drawn into it. The supernal will pulls me. Quote, for I am faint with love. Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 5. Call it sickness, call it madness. I am driven by that will, elementally. I myself cannot understand it. Yes, Rabotai, my friends, now my relationship with the land of Israel is not based on cheshbonot or on machshavot. I belong to the group of the Machanayim dance. A religious land of Israel is part of the paradoxical dance of eternity, which has intoxicated our entire historical existence and from which we cannot free ourselves. Even if many of our friends call out to us, turn back, O maid of Shulam, turn back that we may gaze upon you. Why do you run to a desolate land surrounded by enemies when you can enjoy equal rights in great countries among free civilized nations? That is, of course, Isaac Meir Wise and the Reform Movement, encapsulated into 10 words. Why do you run? This is the Reform Movement's question to secular Zionism. Rabbi Soloveitchik just put it to great English. Quote, why do you run to a desolate land surrounded by enemies when you can enjoy equal rights in great countries among free civilized nations? That's the Reform argument against Zionism. Years later, Reform became the biggest friend of Zionism. Now they can't get enough of Israel. Some live there. They've created a Reform movement in Israel with Reform rabbis. Reform is a big supporter of Israel. It would make Isaac Meir Wise's head spin right off his shoulders. Everything he ever thought, everything he ever fought for, contemporary Reform, chucks it right out the window, at least regarding the land of Israel. Top 214. Our connection with the land of Israel lies beyond cheshbon or hakara and is a manifestation of the supernal will of the Machanayim dance. My membership dues to the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi are now elevated from machshava qua hakara to machshava qua desire to the Machanayim dance. He's gone in his membership dues from machshava qua hakara, from thinking, a very, very pedestrian, low-level thinking and recognition, hakara, to machshava, much higher-level thinking, theoretical, ideological thinking, which would be also encapsulated with the word desire, to the Machanayim dance. Friends, over here is a pretty good place to stop, because if we keep on going, you know what? Yeah, we have a little bit more to go. And I think what we're going to do is this. Let's call it a day over here. We've gone halfway through. And we will pick it up, God willing, next week in Mitzvah Shem. God willing, should all live and be well. Monday afternoon, 1 o'clock, we'll do part two and the conclusion of the Mizrahi and the Jewish Dance of Eternity. It's a beautiful essay, so come on back. And we'll also do the epilogue, which is about 2 pages, Reflections on the Six-Day War, which he delivered right after the war was concluded in June 67. So we'll do both, God willing, next week, and we'll conclude the book. And you can bring along some schnapps and Hoistborn, celebrate the conclusion of this lovely book, The Return to Zion. And after that, we'll begin Kol Dodi Do Feik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's earth-shattering work, not a very big one, not a very long one, his 10 or so assertions about how important the state of Israel is to world Jewry, what it accomplishes for Jews and the whole wide world and Judaism and the whole collective of Jewry. Kol do di do fake, the voice of my beloved knock. And we're talking about God Almighty knocking on our door. You can find it in Safari, I'm told. I'm going to get a hard copy version of it and not trust the web. I can't read it off the web, frankly. But God willing, I'm going to order up a copy, and I'll be happy to read it to you. A very, very influential, monumental work. Kol do di do fake. I look forward to doing that with you upon the completion of our book here. So with God's help, we'll finish it up next week, and we'll let you go. I ask the Almighty for mercy that he allowed this Torah class that we just had to go to the success of the IDF, the release of the captives, the healing of all those in hospitals throughout Israel, the safety and security of all Jews throughout the world, considering what we're looking at on the web with incredible, unbelievable, mind-boggling demonstrations on behalf of Nazis. On behalf of Nazis, that's right. People are rallying for Nazis. In Dagestan, the crazy Muslims storm an airport because they want to tear the people on the airliner limb from limb. Thousands of them storm the airport. I couldn't believe what I saw. I thought it was like early shopping for Christmas in Russia. I thought they were going crazy because some important, you know, toy came on the shelves. I mean, nobody gave me the context. I'm looking at this. They're coming up the escalators. They're running by the hundreds, by the thousands. I'm going, is it a new video game? I mean, are they slashing the prices on TV screens? What's going on over there? The answer is no. They're just trying to find Jews that they can kill with their bare hands. Oh, okay. Well, that makes some sense. I get that. Jewish people are fair game, which is it's open season on Jews. They have to allow themselves to get killed. They must never, ever, ever defend themselves. Oh, we cannot possibly have that now. Now, can we? Jews picking up guns and shooting back at their killers? Oh, heavens. Why, that's such poor taste. Stiff upper lip, don't you know? Jewish people must be mowed down, beheaded, raped, burned alive. That's what Jews deserve, and nothing less. Right, Hamas Nazis? Right, Nazi sympathizers throughout the world? I would say shame on you, but you are shameless. You have no shame. You're just rank murderers. And it frustrates you that you can't murder Jews on the streets. A, because maybe you can't find any. And B, you might just go to a jail. And there, you'll learn what tough love really is. Can't believe the world I'm living in. We're looking at Marxists who actually support Nazis. What a crazy world that is, where hardline leftists actually are in favor of Nazi actions. So much for you, hardline leftists. You yourselves are Nazis. Don't get me started, my friends. Don't get me started. I cannot believe the world I'm living in is so completely immoral. No moral compass at all. It's disgraceful. It's nauseating. And I hate it. But God has a plan. And he's going to let us know that plan one of these days. I look forward to it. I just can't wait for it to happen already. But who knows how it's going to look? Who knows how many more Jews have to die? I mean, you know, and also, there are innocent civilians over there in the Gaza, and they're getting shattered themselves. And it is painful to see little children, you know, dying over there. And there's no question that there is some pain. In the Jewish heart, there's some pain, because we're human people. We're humane. But we got to get in there and uproot and destroy Hamas Nazis. There was no ceasefire discussions during World War II. We didn't let up until the Germans said enough. We now give up officially. We wave the white flag. Everybody's dead. Did anybody complain about German civilian deaths when the American Air Force, the Army, there was no Air Force back then, when the American Army was dropping bomb after bomb on Dresden until there were these incendiary bombs mixed with each other to such an extent that it sucked all the oxygen out of Dresden. Not only were there no human beings alive, there were no cockroaches alive. There was nothing moving in that city when the Americans were done with it. Everybody in there was dead, killed. What did the United Nations say then? Not much. When you got to knock off Nazis, you must knock off Nazis. And sometimes innocents are caught in the collateral damage. It's sad but true. I wish it weren't so. My friends, I wish you a good day, a healthy day, a safe day, a secure day, a prosperous and peaceful day. And with God's help, let's get together again tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of 2 Kings chapter 23. Wishing everybody a good day. Until then, I'm Shmuel Plotzker, and I'm signing out for Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies as we come this close to finishing the Return to Zion, a wonderful work by Rabbi Soloveitchik. Wishing everybody a great one, and we'll see you next week to finish up the book. I'll have a little L'chaim. I'll have orange juice. You can drink whatever you want. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.